What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
There's a 26% chance of failure.
How much farther?
I don't know, I'm not sure. Anyone really come this way? We're close, I know that.
Well, now there's a 35% chance of failure.
I don't want to know. Thank you.
I understand.
No, not audio from a Rogue One production meeting evaluating the film's chances for success, but a clip from the film itself. Diego Luna's Cassian Andor in that clip with Riz Ahmed's Bodhi Rook and the droid K2SO. You got all those names down, Josh?
Oh, yeah. K2. It goes by K2, Adam.
The new 0% chance of failure Star Wars story opens wide this weekend, and we've got a review.
And as a prelude to next week's Top 10 of 2016 show, some thoughts on the year's best performances, documentaries, and more. All that's ahead on Film Spotting.
Yes. This was supposed to be the week we had promised our top 10 films of 2016 roundtable. Michael Phillips, Scott Tobias, our usual crew, along with us, Josh, but we did decide to give ourselves a reprieve. And we're thinking that most listeners out there probably don't mind because they have a lot of catching up to do as well.
We failed in our cram session,
that's
essentially.
It.
Just well, did not feel like, are we yeah, ever going to, we're not going to feel like we're done next
problem.
Week either, but I will feel a little less badly because I'll have seen maybe 4 or 5 more films,
yeah,
and that'll maybe one will crack the list. So
we will get a chance to fit in a few more movies, even though we've already submitted a few ballots at this point in the year. More on that in a second. So part one of our top 10 comes next week. Michael Phillips, we just couldn't pay him enough money to come back. Apparently we hit our limit for requests with Michael.
Well, I even tried, just saw him at the Rogue One screening. I tried to bribe him with one junior mint,
yeah,
on top of your offer,
mm-hmm,
and that didn't do it.
No.
I don't know why.
Michael is out, but we're very excited because along with Scott Tobias from the Next Picture Show, we're going to have Genevieve Kosky on to join our quartet for our top 10 films of 2016.
Genevieve, who helped us usher in the year, right? Wasn't she,
yes,
our guest for the most anticipated
films.
So she's closing it out. Coming full circle.
A perfect bookend. We'd love to hear from you, your favorite film of the year. You can leave us a voicemail. We have already received several voicemails, Josh, as we usually do during this top 10 show, from special guests. And we have a lot of them, but we may get in a few listener picks as well. So all you have to do is call us and leave us a voicemail. Be sure to tell us your name and where you're from. 312-264-0744. Just looking for something around 30 seconds. Of course, if you've got the capability, you can send us an MP3 file as well. Email feedback@filmspotting.net.
So no top 10 show this week, but we still come bearing gifts. The Chicago Film Critics Association just announced the finalists for their year-end awards. And since Adam and I are both voting members of the CFCA, we thought we'd take a run through the ballot, share some of our thoughts on our very favorite things that the 2016 movie year has given us, jumping off of those categories. So we'll hit favorite performances, screenplays, cinematography, music, stuff like that, all later in the show. First, though, we did just come from a screening of Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. Is it a successful mission for the Star Wars Empire?
The world is coming undone. Imperial flags reign across the galaxy.
Can you be trusted without your shackles?
Let's just get this over with, shall we?
We have a mission for you. A major weapons test is imminent. We need to know how to destroy it.
If you're really doing this, I want to help.
Josh, we often do get pretty solid conversations out of movies that we just came from. We call them our still processing reviews. I'm not sure how much there is to process with Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. But on top of that, we actually rushed so quickly here to the studio. Not only did we just come from it, but we haven't really even gone through our notes or tried to make any sense of them. I'm notoriously a terrible note taker, can never read what I've scribbled down anyway. So we're going to see where this goes. I think the question I want to pose to you as we consider Rogue One is that secondary part of the title there, after the colon, A Star Wars Story. Because I think back to The Force Awakens, and one of the criticisms of that film for some, and it was also a point of praise for others, including myself, was how much it seemed indebted to, let's say, the original Star Wars, A New Hope, the story that got the whole saga going. And here we have a film that, knowing that it is the prelude to that story, it feels very familiar and certainly has some touches that fall into that category. I think you use the term often here, Josh, fan service. Was it too much? Was it just enough? Did you like the fact that this felt so at home within the Star Wars universe? Or do you think that director Gareth Edwards found some interesting ways to actually depart from the formula?
Yeah, fan service or franchise care is sometimes what applies to mm-hmm. movies like this. You mentioned notes. I took 2 pages of notes during, wow. Believe it or not, that doesn't mean there's anything of interest in them. And I lost my 1 page. So the other one's somewhere in my backpack. I'm going to have to wing it without it. I think we'll be okay mm-hmm. when it comes to Rogue One. It is not only pretty simple, it's hugely familiar. We mm-hmm. could probably review some elements of Force Awakens and A New Hope and be just fine. People wouldn't know that we're talking about Rogue One. My initial impression is that this is the mistake Force Awakens could have been. Mm-hmm. I feel like they make some choices when it comes to balancing nostalgia and moving the story forward that are the exact wrong choices, whereas Abrams and his collaborators were able to give us just enough nostalgia, just enough mimicry, while also giving us new elements to get excited about, whether those are the characters or the performances. I want to hear what you think about performance here mm-hmm. and how much that affects your experience with Rogue One compared to Force Awakens. Because I think with Daisy Ridley, John Boyega, and Oscar Isaac as the trio at the center of Force Awakens, they just brought that movie to life where people came out of it, and even Adam Driver mm-hmm. in the villain role, that you wanted to follow their stories more. Here we have Felicity Jones as Jyn Erso, the heroine at the start. And I got to say, I still don't really feel like I have much of a sense of who she is. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's a function of the storytelling as much as it is of the performance. Felicity Jones, I thought quite charming in Theory of Everything, is what most people will be familiar with her from. And I don't know if I want to lay any blame completely at her feet, but there's just no sense of this being a character that's exciting, that I have a grasp of. How would you even describe her? You know,
that's a good question.
How would you describe, if someone was saying, what's Jyn like, after we've just spent 2 hours and 15 minutes with her? Is there anything that jumps to mind beyond the sort of action heroine elements that we've seen a million times before?
No, that's a good point. I don't think she has the same dynamic qualities that Daisy Ridley has. And I think Felicity Jones is a really talented actress, and I think she gives a pretty solid performance here overall. I love her big eyes. She has such expressive eyes, and I think Gareth Edwards makes good use of those eyes. But overall, I'm with you, Josh, that in terms of the story and in terms of the structure of it and what she gets to do, she just isn't as compelling a character. And I do think that's part of something that is maybe just missing here overall. And again, we just came from it, so it's hard to really put our fingers on it. But I did feel as if character and character building, character development took a back seat a little bit to, in some cases, the humor, a little too much whiz bang going on, and way too much, frankly, action.
It's almost a war picture.
And that's exactly what it is. I wrote that in my notes. It is very clearly a war movie. Gareth Edwards set out to make here, separate from maybe a Star Wars movie or anything else, he set out to make his version of a Star Wars war movie in the vein of maybe some Vietnam films, certainly some World War II films, where we have characters fighting not just in space or in these desert terrains, but they're often on beaches, or they're fighting in swamps, and there are palm trees. And this is very evocative of settings we've seen in many other types of, again, World War II films, Vietnam films. It's very clear to me that he was going for that, and I applaud him for doing something different. But the climax of this film, which I won't spoil in any way, is protracted in a way that for me did not draw out any real tension or suspense. It just kept going.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's important to note that in terms of structure, there do seem to be attempts to draw out the characters, there's an extended prologue here of Jin as a little girl. Mm-hmm. So ostensibly, we should be well-versed in her history and her personality and what has formed her, and it just does not carry over in the rest of the film. Now, when we both describe Rogue One as a war picture, I don't want to give the sense that that's particularly distinctive. I mean, a handful of the Star Wars films could be described that way. And true. I bring that up to point out that this was the chance for the franchise to do something different, right? This is a Star Wars story. It's a side narrative. It's mm-hmm. an extra bonus. And what we have here is essentially a carbon copy.
Yeah.
And that comes down to how the climax plays out, where there are different battle sequences. We cut back and forth among the three of them, a pattern that A New mm-hmm. Hope established.
Yeah, it feels like Return of the Jedi meets A New Hope. Very familiar.
And in The Force Awakens, I felt that was maybe one of the limitations, that it played it too safe, but I could see why they needed to do that, to get things jump-started, to make us feel comfortable again, especially the people, unlike me, who are alienated by the prequels. Bring them back into the fold, mm-hmm. okay? I get it. Here, you don't even really have that business imperative. I mean, Edwards had, or the producers should have given him the freedom to maybe, if he wanted to go full Force war picture and give us like a Black Hawk Down Star Wars, mm-hmm. something like that, that is within a genre but has its own identity, that would have been really exciting.
It would
have instead,
been.
This is like The Force Awakens in that it even mimics exact shots mm-hmm. from the series before. There's a rebel lookout on
That's
a tower
it, of course, yeah.
that you'll recognize. The editing patterns are the same when we get the attacks on the Imperial ships or when the Death Star, which is at the central of this narrative, when the Death Star is powered up, that's almost like they've lifted those sequences, those montages.
I think they have, by design, for sure.
And there's something that was kind of neat about that in The Force Awakens. In Rogue One, there's something that's just plain tired.
I'm with you, and you mentioned that great prologue. One thing I latched onto really quickly was how muted the color palette was that he's using and how dirty the film is. It doesn't feel like the other films so much as far as them being these fantasies in space. It doesn't have that same use of color, and I think that's a good thing. I tapped into that right away, that, okay, he is trying to do something different. Even when we meet Felicity Jones's character, Jin, a little bit later as she's grown up and she's being transported and she's all dirty and the stormtroopers are caked in dirt. All the controls are caked in dirt. So they're in the muck. And I think that even applies to even the sequences where they, of course, feel very familiar. We've seen them in several films where they're looking for some information or they're trying to get out of a certain place. And we're seeing a very eclectic band of characters. Here, it does feel just a little bit different. It feels more realistic. It feels a little more grounded. It feels, like I said, a little bit dirtier. So I responded to that, Josh, and I thought that maybe Gareth Edwards would carry that over to the feel of the rest of the film. And I have to admit, one of the other issues I have with this movie, and I love this composer, Michael Phillips' go-to guy, Michael Giacchino. There are some nice little inversions mm-hmm. on the familiar themes.
At the beginning.
Yeah, especially at the beginning. And of course, he's an amazing composer. And the music separately is probably pretty wonderful, but I have to say, within the context of this film, that I felt like he was trying to go a little more rogue himself. He was trying to make this down and dirty war film. And yet, whenever a character begins to say something even remotely inspirational or full of feeling, we get that music just pounding away at us. And it really was a distraction for me.
I think it's because there's not a lot there.
No.
Otherwise to work with. I mm-hmm. felt like the music was being pumped up in trying to do some of the work that the performances should have been doing or the staging or some other element. And yeah, that just becomes too much in terms of the music. I referenced at the beginning how I felt like this was maybe the mistake The Force Awakens could have been. And I want to go back to just a few examples of that to give you an idea of what I mean. And one of them is the use of Darth Vader, the references of Darth Vader, whereas Force Awakens is an illusion. Here he is an actual character in the narrative and fairly early on. So I don't think we can consider that a spoiler. Repeated appearances, and instead of borrowing on the power of a mythical figure mm-hmm. and using the myth to do the work, this movie tries to get the figure fully back, and all that does is eat away at the myth for me a little bit. And so I don't like how that works. Also, this is – you know, there are going to be comparisons to the Marvel Cinematic Universe because that's what Disney is trying to do with this. And I don't want these Stan Lee-style cameos to keep popping up in every Star Wars movie we get. I think, you know, there's a Greedo early on, right? And there are a couple others. And then maybe most annoyingly is a R2-D2, C-3PO appearance. Yeah. And this is just, you know, that's where fan service becomes disruptive of the narrative at hand.
I'm with you. If they'd found a way to work C-3PO into the actual narrative as opposed to, oh, hey, everybody, remember him? Yep. We found a way to work it in. It feels shoehorned in, and it doesn't add anything at all.
I don't think it does either. And then the third thing I want to mention is the use of CGI characters. These are all sort of related. How are we going to call upon the past? And I feel like the choices they made in doing that, none of them worked. And one of these is to bring back characters from previous films, except it's not the actors. It's CGI recreations of those actors. And we won't say who, but you don't buy it for a second.
Nope.
It makes the entire scene eerie. That's all you're paying attention to. And it's like we've gone from Star Wars to getting plopped into Polar Express, and it just doesn't work.
No, it doesn't. As far as some of the other performances go, though, Josh, I did like the casting. I appreciate the faces we get, the non-CGI faces we get in this story. Diego Luna, Riz Ahmed. These are really good actors and interesting people to look at. Even some of the people like, and I'm looking at the IMDb page here, so I hope I'm getting them right, but Alistair Petrie plays a general and Genevieve O'Reilly plays the sort of leader of the council of the Rebel Alliance. These aren't familiar faces to me. Maybe to certain people watching, they are. Maybe they're TV stars in England or something. I don't know. I haven't had time to look into it. But you see these just interesting faces, interesting voices. And I think that was a strength of this film, including Ben Mendelsohn.
Yeah, I was wondering if you're going to get to him, right?
Yeah, I mean, we know he can play a bad guy. We know he can play a psychopath. We've seen him in Animal Kingdom. We've seen him in the Batman movies. He's always a very imposing and charismatic figure. And I think he finds a way to play the bad guy, to be this prototypical movie villain in some ways, but not amp up his evilness or really chew on any of the words or the scenery. He's just a bureaucrat, really. He's just a guy who's trying to get a job done, and he has a tremendous amount of personal ambition. And I think that that makes him someone who actually in some ways is a little bit scarier because he does seem so human.
We didn't mention either yet Mads Mikkelsen,
right,
who I think brings a lot to that opening prologue, some gravitas, and makes that maybe the most effective sequence of the film. I feel like I sound like I'm coming down too hard on this picture. I mean, I'm not – this isn't a disaster. It's just the disappointment that I was worried about when it came to Force Awakens. So having Mads Mikkelsen is going to do, you know, get you a long way, and he brings a lot to the film. Donnie Yen, who many people are going to recognize, has a part that I wish had been explored further. The narrative surrounds Jin with this motley crew of supporters, and there's almost too many of them because some of them seem interesting, but there's not enough time to really explore
it.
For instance, he keeps referencing the Force. He's a blind martial artist, but I don't really know if he is a Jedi, and not because we're not supposed to know, not because it's mysterious.
Well, I don't know. They seem to want to be
talking about the Force.
Yeah, they seem to want to be ambiguous about it.
But it was just kind of confusing.
Yeah.
Again,
I think there's a lot of confusion here.
There is a lot of confusion, and he is a strong presence on screen.
Very strong.
Not used well. Alan Tudyk does the voice work for K2SO. I almost said KRS-1. I think that's going to be happening a lot.
I'd like to hear that. I'd like to see that picture.
I think that he's quite funny. You're right.
Quite funny.
If that's what you were referring to, they almost pushed that a little too far, where every time you see K2SO, you know a joke is coming. Mm. And there might have been
– they're mostly effective, though.
And they
really are.
Mostly effective.
There's some great lines.
The timing and the reading of it is good. So I did enjoy that. I will also say that here's an interesting thing that – Rogue One does. That's an element to the other Star Wars pictures, but played up especially strongly here. And there are narrative reasons for it. But it is willing to let characters go. And that is a freedom as a side story it embraces in ways that you'll see coming in a lot of instances, but also ways that took me by surprise and at least altered my experience of watching a Star Wars movie in a way that I really haven't. Even Force Awakens, where a major character dies that I didn't see coming when I went into the screening. Here, this will also make you realize that people are going to be lost along the way. I think it ties in well here in this larger narrative that we're all familiar with. This is the one movie that makes you realize a lot of people have been lost along the way of this ongoing rebellion. And that lends a bit of melancholy to a film that otherwise really struggles to generate true emotion.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I mentioned confusion. I think this ties back into your initial point too, Josh, about the lack of character development or really being drawn in by some of these characters. When we meet Daisy Ridley's character in The Force Awakens, it doesn't feel like they are necessarily building the story, that it's a bunch of plot mechanics. We just get to know her.
Yeah, we're watching her daily life.
We don't really get to experience that here. And I think part of that is because the movie is spending so much time planet hopping, showing us all these different locations, setting up all the different pieces of the puzzle. And I found myself within the first 10 or 15 minutes of this film being a little worn out already by it and just wanting it to settle down a little bit and find a more streamlined way to set up this story and to set up these characters and let it breathe a little bit. This is a very plot-heavy movie when more character would have benefited it.
Yeah, and it especially gets so when it comes to that climax and it relies on multiple levers being pulled and other buttons being pushed.
Yeah.
And I lost, even in my notes, I lost track of what we were supposed to be keeping track of.
Right.
And then when that happens, you're taken out of even the sheer visceral excitement of the scene because you don't know what you're supposed to be rooting for.
You're so right. That's exactly how I felt over the last 20 to 25 minutes of this film. And I think I even started to tune out earlier because of the structure where there is a character motivation. Diego Luna, I'll say this, I won't give away any details, but he has a certain assignment that the movie sets up. And I'll be honest, people out there, after they see it, they can write in, tell me I'm wrong or I'm missing something entirely possible. But he has a certain motivation that drives a lot of the suspense in the middle part of this story. It drives the narrative. And yet I didn't really believe it for a second, because at that point, if you look at it within the context of the whole story, there's really no reason for them to be going after the particular character that he's going after.
Mm-hmm.
They already know what that character has done and what his capabilities have wrought. We've already seen it. It felt as if there was something there in the plot mechanics that was missing, frankly.
What tripped me up there is I think you could argue that the reason he's given that assignment is to take out that character will not let the Empire know what that character has been doing. So it'll still keep them a step ahead in the game. What I didn't buy is
That's not what the character says, though. He says
right,
very clearly.
It's a straightforward, kill assignment.
We need to get rid of him.
And what I didn't buy is why Cassian, Diego Luna's character, changes his mind in that moment. Like that isn't quite sold. Now, but it is connected with, I think, one interesting through line in this movie is this idea of obedience and the cost of obedience.
Yeah.
You have characters, I mean, it's in the title, Rogue One. When are you going to obey? When are you going to go rogue? And what are the reasons for that? So I don't think that particular moment with Cassian demonstrates that well, but I do think that is perhaps a character trait of Jyn's that could have been played up more, in that she not only – a little bit of a Han Solo here – has to choose a side eventually, but also has to choose when is she going to not obey orders.
Mm-hmm.
And when is she – perhaps for her it's more importantly as this outside figure – when is she going to fall in line and obey orders? And then what is your – what is the sacrifice that comes with that? Because there are, as I mentioned, a number of instances of characters making sacrifices in this film that is a distinction of it, and maybe that's enough for a more generous Star Wars fan to hold on to if they see this picture and enjoy it a little bit more than you and I did.
That is Rogue One, a Star Wars story. We look forward to all of the emails telling us how wrong we were here in our initial reaction to the movie. feedback@filmspotting.net is our email address. A quick plug for our friends at Film Spotting SVU. Their latest episode looks at the movie Creed, one of the better films of last year, and then they look at follow-ups to Sundance Breakthroughs. Those are movies that are available right now via streaming or on demand. Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on cable, the art house in your house. Learn more at rentmoviesondemand.com.
over at the Next Picture Show. It's a new episode week that should be out and available right now. They're going to be pairing Disney's latest hit, Moana, with 1998's Mulan.
That's right in your wheelhouse, Josh.
Mulan is a favorite in our house, though it's been a while since I've seen it. We're going to talk a little bit of animated films. Should we hit that category when we come back and look at some of the Chicago Film Critics Association nominees for the 2016 awards? Stay with us.
I left drinking on the city train to spend some time on the road. Then one morning I woke up in LA, caught my breath on the coast. I've been going through a change. I'm just walking in a haze. I'm not ready to turn. No woman.
I'm seeing good, and you ain't it. And stop putting your head down in my house. You know my rule. It's all love and all pride in this house. You feel me?
A clip there from director Barry Jenkins, almost universally praised Moonlight, a film, Josh, we loved along with most everyone else. But one of the film's performances that I don't think we did manage to highlight in our review was that one, Janelle Monáe as Teresa. She becomes a kind of surrogate mother to the film's central figure, Chiron. Monáe is pretty well known as a musician, but she did get a surprising amount of love from the Chicago Film Critics Association when they announced their finalists for the year-end awards earlier this week. And Josh, we're doing this because if you look back at the show, we have made a few changes over the years, evolved, if you will, out of some familiar segments. We used to do a big year-end blowout where we would, after doing the top 10 show, spend a lot of time talking about best actress and best actor and all that stuff. And it was fun, but it got maybe a little bit redundant as we spent so much time on the end of the year. And then it was especially redundant when we got into all the Oscar talk as well. So we've dialed back the blowouts. We've dialed back the Oscar talk. But it's still fun to get into some of these categories and highlight some of the performances and other technical achievements that if we don't take advantage of it here, we might not otherwise get to. So using the Chicago Film Critics Association nominees, that's what we're going to do as our jumping off point for this larger discussion. And as we go, we may really get into how we voted when we had to submit our ballot. Now, I will also note that we are taping this the day after the finalists for the Chicago Film Critics Association nominations were announced. By the time people hear this show this weekend, those winners will have already been announced, and we will link to them in our show notes over at filmspotting.net. But as of right now, we haven't even submitted our final ballots yet, just the initial ones.
Yeah, we got a few days till we have to do that. And as far as Most Promising Performer goes, you know, Monáe, she did some voice work, I think like Rio 2 and maybe some television voice work. But yeah, this is her first live action performance in Moonlight, and then she's also in Hidden Figures, which is coming out around Christmas time, I believe. So I didn't really consider her when I voted in this category, though I think she's quite good in Moonlight. I was enraptured with Lily Gladstone from Certain Women, so that was the main person I was rooting for in the Most Promising Performer category. I will also say that Lucas Hedges, who is a nominee, was really good in Manchester by the Sea. One of those, I'm glad to see he's in here because he's one of those kid performances so dead on to a teenager that it can be overlooked, right? Because you're like, well, that's just how kids are. And I think he's better than that. Royalty Hightower is another nominee. The lead in The Fitz. When I revisited that, I was even more impressed by her performance. It's not one of the things I highlighted when we reviewed the film. I think it's a stronger directorial effort. And revisiting it, it's not just the physicality of her performance that really convinced me of her talent, but really the way that she's getting us into the interior experience of a girl who's very closed off. And then Trevante Rhodes, I know we talked about, who is the last nominee for Most Promising Performer from Moonlight as the grown Chiron. That is, man, that last section where it's pretty much just him and Andre Holland as the grown Kevin is so heartbreaking. And yeah, Trevante Rhodes' performance is a big part of that.
He definitely is. You named him there. Lily Gladstone, Lucas Hedges, Royalty Hightower, Trevante Rhodes, and Janelle Monáe not only nominated for Moonlight, but also for playing Mary Jackson in Hidden Figures. And we were talking about this before we came here. I got the screener for that in the mail a couple days ago. Otherwise, completely oblivious to this film, had no idea what it was about, had never even heard the name. It is a period space race drama. She stars along with Taraji P. Henson and Octavia Spencer in that one, and it got a couple nominations here, so that is one of the candidates that I have not seen. For me, I had both Lily Gladstone and Trevante Rhodes at the top of my ballot. They were one and two, and depending on my mood that day, I could easily switch them and put Rhodes in that number one spot. They're both just that good. Royalty Hightower and Hedges, for me, were just outside my ballot, Josh, just outside the top five in the six and seven slot. And I did frankly forget about Janelle Monáe from Moonlight. I don't know that she would have crept up into the mix here because there were so many other good candidates this year. Some of the ones I would argue our brethren in the CFCA may have overlooked: Angourie Rice from The Nice Guys as the daughter of Ryan Gosling, my beloved Sing Street star Ferdia Walsh-Pilo, and another star from Moonlight, Ashton Sanders, was among my top five most promising performers.
So most promising filmmaker is the next category, and that included Kelly Freeman Craig, who directed The Edge of 17, Robert Eggers directed The Witch, Anna Rose Holmer of The Fitz, Travis Knight of Kubo and the Two Strings animated film, and then Trey Edward Schultz from Creesia. For me, I knew where I was going right away. At the top of my ballot was Anna Rose Holmer from The Fitz, so I'm glad to see that she was there. Craig, also a fresh voice. Eggers, I think it's going to be really interesting to see what he does, whether he sticks with horror or goes in another direction, but you can't deny that he brought an original vision to The Witch. Kubo, I enjoyed.
Yeah, me too.
But I'm not one of its huge enthusiasts, where I know a lot of people have it as their favorite animated film of the year. And I know Creesia also enjoyed, but you're a much bigger fan than me. So I'm wondering, was Schultz at the top of your ballot?
Yeah, he was actually at the top of my ballot. And Kelly Freeman Craig for The Edge of 17 was certainly among my top five. And this is how tough this category was. I had The Fitz and Anna Rose Holmer just outside of those five, despite my love for the movie The Fitz. I considered Travis Knight for Kubo, and I also did give strong consideration to Robert Eggers, even though I was mixed on The Witch. Certainly didn't love it as much as you did, or as many people I know did. The fact is, you're absolutely right. You can't help but be really excited for whatever you're going to see from him next, just because of the vision of that film, the style of that film, someone very much in control, someone who knew what he was trying to capture from a mood and tone perspective. So I think he's a tremendous talent, and I am excited to see what he's going to do next. A couple names that I would have suggested to be in this mix as well: Dan Trachtenberg for 10 Cloverfield Lane and Richard Tanna for South Side With You, a movie that I think a lot of people slept on this year and a lot of people just didn't see it. And it's really good. The Barack Obama, Michelle Obama first date movie. It's really good, really well written by Tanna, and also really well directed by him.
So let's take a look at Best Original Score, and the CFCA nominees there are Johan Johansson for Arrival, Mika Levy for Jackie, and we know Mika Levy from Under the Skin, a soundtrack we praised quite a bit when that came out, Justin Hurwitz, the mastermind behind La La Land. Moonlight got a nomination here. Nicholas Britell is the composer there. And then Cliff Martinez for Nicholas Winding Refn's The Neon Demon. So there's like a knockout champ in this room. It's going to be hard to, at least for me, vote against La La Land, even though I'll admit I have not seen Jackie yet. But all of those other scores are ones that I noted while I was watching the film.
Yes.
Remember these when it comes down to awards time. I think for Arrival, a movie I liked but I didn't fall in love with, one of my favorite things is the Johan Johansson score, especially at the beginning when they're entering the spaceship, and very effective there. But really, how I can't go against Hurwitz and the importance, not only just the fact that I've been listening to that music on its own, which I don't do a lot of when it comes to movie soundtracks, but what it means to that film.
City of stars, are you shining just for me? City of stars, there's so much that I can't see.
It's hard to argue against.
Yeah, it is hard to argue against, though, having seen Jackie, a movie I am overall pretty mixed on. One of the best things about that film is that Mika Levy score. So it's close competition between Levy and Hurwitz for me. This one, our colleagues definitely got it right, because not only did I have Jackie and La La Land on my ballot, I also had Moonlight and The Neon Demon, Cliff Martinez's score. And Arrival was my number six. It was one I had just left off, Josh. The only other score I'd throw in the mix here, the one I did consider in my number five slot, was Brian McComber's score for Krisha. What Trey Edward Schultz does with that score, how he employs it, is a key asset to that film as well in terms of ratcheting up the tension. And there's already a lot of tension to go around, but that music really takes it to another level.
And let me just add, I apologize, I don't have the composer's names handy. I'm kind of doing this off the cuff, but the other titles I considered were The Fits. My brother-in-law just watched that last night, and he said today, he texted me, I'm listening to the score now because it was so cool, and it does bring an eeriness to that film you might not expect. And then The Last Days in the Desert, the Ewan McGregor film.
I still haven't seen
also,
it.
That has also kind of an unsettling score, one that puts you just enough off edge that works for what the film's trying to do.
That takes us to Best Editing, and the CFCA finalists are camera person Nels Bangerter, the editor, Jackie Sebastian Sepulveda, the editor, La La Land, Tom Cross, Jennifer Lame edited Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight, Joy McMillan and Nat Sanders, the editors there. How did the CFCA do on this one, Josh?
Well, they've got the right one, right? It's got to be camera person. I mean, this is the collage film, the documentary compiled of extraneous footage that Kirsten Johnson, the director, who is formerly a cinematographer, has been collecting throughout a 25-year career. Here, she puts it together in the form of a memoir, and it is really how those archival images are juxtaposed, formed into montage that allows real meaning to emerge from that film. Mm-hmm. That film is a editing achievement. For a film about cinematography, it's an editing achievement first, I think. So I'm glad to see that that is in the mix. Of course, whenever you're talking about effective movie musicals, you have to keep in mind how much work the editing is doing, and the less you notice it, the better work it's doing, right? So that puts La La Land up there for me as well. So I'm glad to see both of those in the running.
Yeah, I had camera person, I had Jackie and La La Land all on my ballot, and Moonlight was really close. It was my number six. Manchester by the Sea was just outside my top 10, but it was one I made note of. I think for me, Josh, the two omissions here, the two I think are certainly worthy of more consideration, are a couple of other documentaries in addition to camera person. Tower, the Golden Brick finalist from Keith Maitland, is a film that relies on archival footage, also animated interviews and other rotoscoped animation that was created for this film. The soundscape with actual audio from the time and the interviews, it's it's a feat of editing as well, without a doubt. That's a real technical achievement. And I think you also have to recognize OJ Made in America. Yes, it is seven some hours long or whatever when you look at all five parts. But the scale and the scope of that story and how they use all of the different pieces they have at their disposal to tell that story. There are a lot of different directions you could go, and certainly no shortage of interviews and no shortage of courtroom footage and other aspects to that whole OJ story that you could work in. And I think it's a masterpiece. It's really one of the achievements of the year in cinema, and the editing is a big reason why.
So next up is cinematography, one of my favorite categories, and perhaps the year's achievement in cinematography is on this list, and the second one is not on this list.
Okay.
So let me name the nominees first. For best cinematography from the CFCA are The Handmaiden, Jackie, La La Land, Moonlight, and then Silence. Moonlight is the one that, for me, that's the best thing about the movie is the cinematography. The other one I would add that the cinematography is the best thing about it, and I think it's a very good movie, so there's a lot of other good things going on, is The Neon Demon. Both of those, it's not just that they look great, okay? I think sometimes movies that look great get this award, but it's that the cinematography is integral to what those movies are trying to do.
Yeah.
So for Moonlight, it's the glow of empathy. I talked about very much about how the skin tones are given such care and attention in that film. That's crucial. In The Neon Demon, it's the glare of narcissism and the way that that strobe light, fluorescent, in-your-face glare permeates through that film is, again, just makes the movie visually communicate what it's trying to do purely through the cinematography. So those were at the top of my list. From this list, yes, La La Land also makes use of the lighting. We talked about that. It's that responsive lighting that the movie has. I would add, again, Last Days in the Desert, Emmanuel Lubezki doing excellent work as usual there. And then Jaron Blaschke from The Witch is another title that would have been on my final ballot.
Well, there's a lot of crossover with this category. For me, four of these five were on my ballot. The Handmaiden, Jackie, La La Land, and Moonlight. Jackie fits exactly what you're saying. Overall, I am not a huge fan of this film, Josh. It is not a movie that is going to make my top 35 or maybe even 40 of the year. But in terms of the editing and the camera work, that is integral to what the director, Pablo Larraine, is doing. It conveys really everything about the film, because maybe some of the performances and the writing is a weakness with this movie, but certainly the look of this film and the compositions and the movement is a real strength. So I'm a fan of those four, certainly. And Silence, Rodrigo Prieto always does fine work. Martin Scorsese film, not surprised to see it here. One I thought about, though, actually outside of my top 10, there were just so many good ones to consider. The Neon Demon's one of them. The other one I would throw in the mix here for sure, Josh, and we disagreed about this film, and we disagreed about how effective maybe the cinematography was, but I love Michael McDonough's work in Sunset Song. That was also among my top five.
Yeah, for me, that is maybe in the too pretty category.
Yeah.
I think that was one of the disagreements we had over it. So, all right, best art direction and production design. The CFCA nominees are The Handmaiden, Park Chan-wook, no surprise there. Jackie, again, a lot of Jackie. Chicago Film Critics Association loves Jackie. La La Land, The Neon Demon, and The Witch. The one that I would probably have wanted to see in there is Cemetery of Splendor, the Apichatpong Werastikun film.
I love it when you say his name.
Yeah, I got it that time. That could have been cinematography as well, because the way there are these, I'll probably get into it in a future show, but there are these particular glowing fixtures that play a crucial role to that film that are both used through the cinematography and the production design and art direction that are crucial. But otherwise, yeah, a respectable list here. I mean, Nicholas Winding Refn film, you've got to have that in this category. And The Neon Demon is maybe the most art-directed film of his yet.
Maybe. For me, actually, it was just outside the top five. I had The Neon Demon and The Witch in my six and seven slots. But I had Handmaiden and La La again on the ballot. And I had Jackie on the ballot. So I'm one of the people who is guilty of anointing Jackie, apparently, as a masterpiece. Now, I was not one of the people who voted for it for Best Picture, so you can't blame me for that. We'll get there in a moment. For me, the two they missed in this category, Sunset Song, again, the film from Terrence Davies, but also the Coen brothers, your beloved Hail Caesar.
Yeah, I was going to throw that in. I mean, I don't know why that's being forgotten in a lot of these categories.
I'm guilty of
maybe
that.
Because it came out so early in the year.
And I'm not going to have time to revisit it. So
I'll be doing some correcting of that a little later on.
Well, this should be brief because our next category is Best Foreign Language Film. And this is a category that I'm pretty sure when I submitted my initial ballot, I punted on because I just didn't think it was fair. I had not seen enough of the candidates, and I really only felt extremely strongly about one of the films. And so I didn't vote for it. And as the finalists have come out, they are Elle, The Handmaiden, Julieta, Neruda, the other film from Pablo Larraín this year, along with Jackie and Tony Erdmann, the much praised Tony Erdmann. I have only seen at this point, Josh, The Handmaiden, and I have seen Elle. I just watched it last night. So of these five, I love The Handmaiden. I love the Park Chan-wook film. I would certainly be very happy if it won this category, but I think I'm going to have to abstain from voting just because I haven't seen enough films.
Well, I was way off watching different foreign language films than the other voters this year. I did see Tony Erdmann and am pleased to see it on this list. I think Julieta is for some reason being overlooked at the year end. It's a really strong Almodovar film, a mystery, but as emotional as you might expect, and some excellent performances in there. So I'm glad to see it here, but I had other titles that I would have put ahead of it, and Cemetery of Splendor would have been one of those. Rams from our Nordic Cinema Marathon. We
Which
both
wasn't even on the ballot.
Well, there's some debate about what year it was released, but I'd put that on there. Michel Gondry's Microbe and Gasoline, quiet, lovely little film, not full of antic tics, even though I like his antic tics that people have slept on this year. And then you could include the animated film April and the Extraordinary World, which I liked quite a bit.
We were both fans of that film.
I would have gone in that direction in this category. Documentary. Here, I'm fairly certain you had covered a little bit better. How many of our Golden Brick nominees this year are documentaries?
Yeah, there's a fair number.
Two or three.
Tower. Are we talking about the finalists or the overall,
the
shortlist?
Yeah.
Of
two, I
the
think.
Finalists, the finalists, we have two on there. Yeah.
Yeah, and Tower is one of those that is also a Chicago Film Critics Association nominee, camera person, a CFCA nominee, and a
That's
Golden Brick nominee. And then also nominated by the CFCA, Life Animated. This is about an autistic child who found a way to communicate with his family through the help of Disney films. The aforementioned O.J. Made in America, and then Wiener, about disgraced Congressman Anthony Wiener. Adam, you're going O.J., I'm assuming.
Well, maybe. Let's see what happens next week on the show.
Okay.
But Camera Person, O.J. Made in America, and Tower were all certainly on my ballot and were emphatic choices by me. Life Animated is one I have not caught up with yet and don't know that I'm going to actually be able to make the time before we do our top 10 show. We'll see before the end of the year. Wiener is one I'm not at all surprised to see on this list. I think it is, and I hate to use this word because it sounds very dismissive, but it's just accurate in this case. I think it's one of the more overrated films of the year. Some people just love this movie, and I get it in terms of feeling like you have some access that is rare in these types of documentaries, and just in terms of watching a train wreck in front of your eyes, a human train wreck, there is something undoubtedly compelling about it, but I have a lot of issues with some of the choices the directors make, as I've articulated briefly on the show. So Wiener, not really in contention for me. The Witness, one of our Golden Brick finalists, there you go, three of them documentaries, actually, three of the five. The Witness is one I obviously would have considered in the mix, and I'll throw out two other names. Mapplethorpe, A Life in Pictures, the documentary that aired on HBO about the photographer, Robert Mapplethorpe. And I think I liked it a little bit more than you, but I'm surprised, especially in a film critics group and knowing some of these Chicago film critics the way I do, I thought for sure De Palma was going to sneak in there with all that cinephile love for that documentary directed by Noah Baumbach and Jake Paltrow. But apparently not in the top five.
Two titles that I would throw out there worth considering would be Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids, the Jonathan Demme concert documentary. Just a blast. I mean, just a pure rush to watch. And also Pervert Park. This is a film that got very limited release documentary, very rough to watch, wrenching about sex offenders who've been released from prison, and because they are very restricted in where they can live, mm-hmm. there is this mobile home park that is just the right distance away from schools and so forth. And this is a documentary from Scandinavian filmmakers, I want to say, who conduct a lot of interviews there. So again, a rough watch, but very compelling.
Our next category, animated feature, the nominees, Kubo and the Two Strings, Moana, The Red Turtle, Tower, and Zootopia. For me, Josh, The Red Turtle is a film I'm not familiar with and didn't get a chance to see, but the other four nominees here, Josh, were all on my ballot. They missed April and the Extraordinary World, a film you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, and that's one that I think is stronger than Kubo, Moana, and Zootopia. Enjoyed mm-hmm. all three of those, but I think April's a stronger film, and Tower is absolutely more of an achievement in terms of the animation. Mm-hmm. I know it's also in the documentary category, and it's not what you would – this rotoscoping technique applied to interviews is maybe not what people think of as animation, but
right.
let's broaden the yeah. horizons here in yeah. this category, right?
Yeah, I can't wait until we have Scott and Genevieve on next week, because over the weekend I saw a tweet from Scott about Tower, and he said that he and Genevieve have a philosophical difference about whether or not Tower, and again, it was Twitter, we didn't get into the full conversation, but whether or not it should be eligible for either or both animated or best documentary. And I guess I can see that because it does combine some footage that, well, it's obviously animated, it's created,
yeah.
it's recreated. And then from an animation standpoint, there are elements of the film that are not animated, but the vast majority of the film is animated, so I can't imagine an argument against it fitting into that category. And really, the definition of documentary has so expanded
oh, yeah.
just in the past 5 to 10 years that it checks all the boxes for me. So I'll be curious to hear how that plays out.
Should we move on to the acting categories?
Let's do it.
Here? Okay, so Best Supporting Actor, the Chicago Film Critics have nominated Mahershala Ali from Moonlight, Alden Ehrenreich from Hail Caesar, Ben Foster from Hell or High Water, Lucas Hedges, the teen we mentioned before in Manchester by the Sea, Trevante Rhodes, also a Most Promising Performer nominee from Moonlight, and then Michael Shannon from Nocturnal Animals.
Yes, six finalists here instead of the usual five. There must have been a tie. Pretty good on this category, Josh. Ali, Ehrenreich, Rhodes, they were in my top three. I'm excited to see them here. I think one of those three certainly has the best chance at winning. Lucas Hedges wasn't in my top 10. Either was Ben Foster, but I think they're both solid. If one of them won, that wouldn't disappoint me. I think this, for me, was just the toughest category. I had 14 or 15 candidates
yeah.
for Best Supporting Actor who I felt almost equally about. And Michael Shannon, Nocturnal Animals, that's a performance in a film we both haven't seen. For me, the ones they missed, again, I had so many to choose from here. Glenn Powell and Richard Linklater's Everybody Wants Some. He plays Finn. Craig Robinson from Morris from America. We split a little bit on that movie, but we definitely agree on Robinson's performance. And Tom Bennett from Love and Friendship. I thought for sure he was going to make my top five when I saw that performance because it's just so gleefully hilarious.
Yeah.
But as I thought about it, and I thought about how it fits within that film and how crucial it is to the story. I mean, you could take that out and you certainly would have lost some laughs, but you wouldn't otherwise would have really lost anything with the narrative. That's at least what I recall of that film, having seen it back in the summer. So didn't make my top five, but I think he was probably my number six.
An impressive establishment you have here, sir. My congratulations. Immaculate.
Mr. Corsi is Mrs. Vernon's brother.
Very good.
It's her husband, Charles Vernon, who has Churchill.
Churchill? That's how you say it? Altogether like that? Churchill? Oh, well, that explains a lot. You see, I'd heard church and hill, but couldn't find either. All I could see was this big house. Fine name, Churchill.
Well, I just watched Love and Friendship, and knowing all the praise that had come for Tom Bennett, I was eagerly anticipating his scenes, and he's hysterical. I would put him in the scene stealer category
yeah,
more
no,
than
that's
the
more
best supporting. So I didn't have him on my ballot as much as I enjoyed that performance. Alden Ehrenreich has to take this thing.
I know.
I mean, you only
so we agree
get,
on that.
You only
even
get a
over
brand
the Moonlight
new,
guys.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm with you too.
When there's someone who pops off the screen with that much charisma and strength,
I know.
And you just want to see everything he does afterwards, he's got to get it. But I'm with you on Robinson. Best thing about Morris from America, and I love seeing comedians get a chance mm-hmm. to show the other skills that they have, which Robinson definitely does there. I put Woody Harrelson on my ballot for The Edge of 17.
Just missed it for me.
He's maybe a scene stealer too, except I think to your point about Tom Bennett, he is more of a crucial part in what's going on with that narrative.
Yeah.
And then another one, I will always find a way to champion a vocal performance in an acting category because I believe that needs to happen and those need to be recognized. For me this year, that was Idris Elba in The Jungle Book as Shere Khan. I mean, he – talk about an iconic character to have to recreate and still make work in the film. He does it there.
I can't help but notice there's this strange odor today. What is it? The scent that I'm on. I almost think it was some kind of man cub.
Great choice. Mowgli, Best Supporting Actress. The five nominees for the Chicago Film Critics are Viola Davis for Fences, Lily Gladstone for Certain Women, Naomi Harris for Moonlight, Janelle Monáe for Hidden Figures, and Michelle Williams, Manchester by the Sea. We've already talked a little bit about Monáe. She's up for Most Promising Performer, along with Lily Gladstone for Kelly Reichardt's Certain Women. Did you have any of these on your ballot, Josh?
So Lily Gladstone is definitely on my ballot. I think I had her ranked second. I did have Michelle Williams on as well. Now, I didn't vote for Viola Davis in Fences, primarily because I haven't seen Fences yet.
No, me neither.
I did vote for her in Suicide Squad.
Oh, man.
She almost saves that movie. And when Angelica Bastien was on...
If anybody could, it's her.
Yeah, and we both came out of that film not knowing what are we going to say positively about this. And it wasn't even like having to search for desperation. It was like, wow, she somehow formed an interesting character that we wanted to know more about amidst that train wreck. So you got to give her credit for that. I mentioned in the Pedro Almodóvar film, Julieta, how good the acting is. Adriana Ugarte plays the younger version of Julieta in that film and gives a great performance. They have her in the supporting category, though she's on screen quite a bit. Another name I would throw out there is Abby Lee from The Neon Demon, one of the praying mantis models we talked about. I think she managed to step apart from that pair and give a distinct performance in one of my favorite films of the year.
Well, not much overlap here for me. Gladstone is the only person I also had on my ballot, though I did think about Naomi Harris and Michelle Williams. She's one of our best actresses going in movies, period. So I do not bemoan at all seeing her among the finalists. But I remember on Facebook about a week ago giving our friend Matt Singer from Film Spotting SVU some grief because he was sharing some of the picks from the New York critics. And Michelle Williams won for Certain Women and Manchester by the Sea. And
really?
I know this is tremendously ironic that me, the ultimate cheater here on the show with my top five lists over the years, that I would throw stones at the New York film critics for giving it to a performer for two performances. But I just don't think that's fair because I think, Josh, that's a case where one of those performances alone maybe wasn't strong enough to earn it on its own. So they gave it a cumulative award. And I don't think that's what this should ultimately be about.
Right,
so
yeah, your favorite.
I'm throwing a grenade there at the New York film critics.
You will not stand for that.
No, I won't. She was in my top 15 or so, but there were just so many other really strong candidates. For me, some of the ones that got overlooked, Carmen Ejogo for Born to be Blue, Tyree Kim in Park Chan-wook's The Handmaiden. Jenna Malone is the one I singled out from The Neon Demon instead of Abby Lee. And Don't Think Twice, the improv comedy movie from Mike Birbiglia. By far, the breakout star of that is Gillian Jacobs of Community fame. She gives a really layered, deep performance that not only calls on her range of emotion and vulnerability, but also her comedic skills. So I think some big names there that were unfortunately missed. That brings us to Best Actress, Josh.
Best Actress. So the Chicago Film Critics have nominated Amy Adams for Arrival, Rebecca Hall for Christine, Isabelle Huppert for Elle, Natalie Portman for Jackie, and Emma Stone for La La Land. From that list, I would agree with Emma Stone. She was on my ballot, but I would also say that Arrival is the only other film that I've seen. Okay. So I have some work to do before voting in that category. I would have liked to have seen Ruth Negga there for Loving. Mm-hmm. I think that is one of the best performances of the year. This one I had no expectations to see, but it really did carry me through what was at times a difficult film that I ended up appreciating. Janjira Pongpas Widner is the lead in Cemetery of Splendor, and I'll talk about that film probably in our next episode, so I'll save that for then. Hailee Steinfeld in The Edge of 17, I really do think, yes, you can give a Best Actress award to someone in a teen movie, especially when it's this good. And then I mentioned Emma Stone. My other nominee was Kate Beckinsale from Love and Friendship. What a delight. So smart.
Yes.
So funny. Such impeccable timing, and really just teased out the comedy that Whit Stillman was going for in that picture.
It's shocking. I can't believe it.
That's very shocking.
A gentleman entrusted with correspondence marked private reads it regardless, and then because of a few confidential remarks, the obloquy is mine. And who has acted badly in this affair? Only you and I stand innocent of reading other people's correspondence.
Unluckily, Lady Mannering also wormed out of her husband's servant that Mannering visited you in private.
Oh. Facts are horrid things.
Shocked she didn't get a nomination here. Shocked. I really thought that she would. And there's a lot of overlap between us, Josh, not so much me and the rest of the Chicago film critics. This is the only category where I had zero overlap with the top five. And in fairness to Rebecca Hall, believe it or not, Christine, one of the movies I've talked about incessantly in preview shows this year leading up to this point, I haven't seen it yet. I just keep putting it off to watch other things. And I watched the other Christine Chubbuck movie, Kate Plays Christine, instead. But of those four, Emma Stone, I had rated the highest, just outside of my top five. I do like Amy Adams quite a bit in Arrival. And Natalie Portman, I want you to see Jackie just because I want to talk to you about her performance.
Okay.
She goes for something. She makes a very bold choice in terms of how she embodies Jackie Kennedy, mainly vocally. And I could see that being very distracting for some people, but I think she owns it. And physically, just in terms of her posture, the way she surveys a room, it's very expressive. And I think that's mostly a good thing. So I have a lot of respect for Portman, even though she wasn't one I put on my ballot. Isabelle Huppert is the tougher one, Josh, because she is also one of these real international cinematic treasures. I would put her up there with Juliette Binoche in terms of just indispensable, always watchable actresses. And I just did, as I mentioned, catch up with Elle, the Paul Verhoeven movie. And despite how good she always is, I think it's a pretty lifeless performance. And if you see the movie, you could argue that, well, that's part of the character she's playing. She's someone who's very detached, but it did not stand out to me the way so many of her other performances do. And that movie overall, I will just take a moment to say, I think it's impossible to talk about and really get into it without getting into spoiler territory. And I'm obviously not going to do that, but Michael Phillips, who I saw at that Rogue One screening as well, I mentioned that I had just seen this movie. He said, yeah, he liked it, didn't love it, but liked it. And that's where I'm at this point. He said it perfectly, so wonderfully succinctly, as Michael often does. He said the movie is reprehensible, but not dismissible. And that is the quote. I mean, that should be on the poster for Elle, because it's a movie.
Well, that can describe a lot of Verhoeven, right?
That's what I was just going to say.
Yeah.
He is a guy who, you watch this film and you think of it as bourgeois pulp. It's trashy as hell. It feels so much more serious and austere because, maybe because it's subtitled and because the characters seem to come from an upper class. And there's all of this window dressing about psychology and about just the darkness of the human soul and religion as well, Josh, in this film. So it feels maybe more substantive than it really is. At its core, it's not really that different than Basic Instinct. I mean, Verhoeven is, for better or for worse, a true vulgarian. And I say that with no judgment. Even when I say reprehensible, I personally am not indicting Verhoeven for the way he handles the material here, at least coming off my first viewing of the film. But he is a vulgarian, and there is something appealing about that. I'm not sure by the end of it, Josh, it adds up to anything at all, but it's also one of those movies that I think allows itself to be a little bit of a puzzle that, in retrospect, you can think about it and start to take out pieces, move them around, interpret scenes the way you want to fit various readings of the film. And when you do that, it becomes a little bit more interesting. So Elle is certainly a movie worth talking about, even though it isn't a film for me that is going to rate it all near my top 10. And Who Pairs performance also not really in the mix. The ones they miss, you named three of them for sure. Beckinsale, Ruth Negga from Jeff Nichols' Loving, and Haley Steinfeld from The Edge of 17. Minhee Kim in The Handmaiden is one I had on my ballot. And Krisha Fairchild, the star of Trey Edward Schultz's Krisha.
Yeah. Hard to imagine that film without her, right?
There's something about her style of acting in that film that I have no idea what to call it, how to label it, how really to describe it. It's a challenge I have, I guess, for next week's show. Best Actor.
So Best Actor, the nominees from the Chicago Film Critics, Casey Affleck for Manchester by the Sea, Adam Driver for Patterson, that's the latest from Jim Jarmusch, Joel Edgerton from Loving, Colin Farrell, The Lobster, and Denzel Washington, Fences. So glad to see Colin Farrell on here for The Lobster because he was on my ballot and didn't expect people to really get in sync with that performance. It's one that could fit in well with the contemporary Nordic cinema marathon we did this year, mm-hmm. I think, Adam, because it is so dry yet so funny if you pick up on what he's doing there. Adam Driver also is really good in Patterson. And if that's the sort of performance I think about that guy, that character, every once in a while since I've seen it, and I just kind of chuckle about his life.
No, that's a good point.
But it's not so understated. Oh, it's so,
it's so understated that it doesn't call attention to itself. And that's actually why it's a great performance, but probably why I didn't consider it for my top five.
Oh, I had it on there. And other names I would, I was definitely on board with Casey Affleck. I think that probably is the Best Actor performance of the year for me. And maybe we'll get a chance to talk about that a little bit more. The other one on my ballot was Peter Simonischek. This is the lead, the title character in Tony Erdmann.
Okay.
And this is one of those here's how I know it's good. Okay. He plays a father who's incredibly embarrassing, enjoys practical jokes, and is always making the moment about him in an awkward way, okay? The sort of person that would give me hives. And at the end of this film, I had deep affection for the guy.
Okay.
And so I'm just giving it to Peter Simonischek for being able to pull that off. It's really a remarkable performance. Let me throw a couple out here that weren't on my ballot but I think should be given consideration. Mm-hmm. Speaking of having forgotten about Hail Caesar, Josh Brolin is so crucial to making that film more than just a frothy comedy. Ewan McGregor is really good in Last Days in the Desert. And Ralph Ineson from The Witch. When I watched that again, mm-hmm. I realized how crucial that father, this father where everything is coming apart at the seams largely because of his decisions that he's made.
Mm-hmm.
He's somewhat like a kinder, gentler Jack Nicholson in The Shining. And it really made
that's
that,
a good way to put it.
A second view into that film enjoyable.
I really like him, but the performances for that film that I gave strong consideration to for my ballot were Harvey Scrimshaw for Best Supporting Actor, who plays the young brother, and then his older sister, Anya Taylor-Joy, also got some consideration from me. For Best Actor, Casey Affleck for Manchester by the Sea, the only one of these five who was on my ballot. Joel Edgerton, though, was in my top 10. And like I said, I kind of overlooked Adam Driver and I overlooked Colin Farrell, but I have no problem seeing them on this list. I think they're both really good performances, and Denzel, we still need to see. For me, the names they missed, Ethan Hawke, Born to Be Blue, playing Chet Baker.
Can't you just give like a New York Film Critics Circle Award to Ethan Hawke? Wouldn't you like to do that?
I mean,
he was in like six things and you loved them all this year.
He wouldn't just win Best Actor. He'd just win
Best Year?
God of the Year
Best
or
year.
Something. I don't know. Best Year. For Hell or High Water, Chris Pine.
Chris Pine was on my list.
And Jeff Bridges.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chris Pine was on my list.
I'm shocked Jeff Bridges isn't on here. And my guy, Michael Shannon from Midnight Special, was also in the mix for me. That brings us to the final two categories, and we're really just going to list them because I don't think we want to get into Best Director or Best Picture territory.
The director
category. It's
going
to tip our hand too much for next week. But Best Director, it went to Chazelle for La La Land, Barry Jenkins, Moonlight, Pablo Larraín, Jackie Lonergan for Manchester by the Sea, and Park Chan-wook for The Handmaiden.
Yeah, and this category is really, for me, tied in too closely to the Best of the Year.
Yeah.
So it's best that we do save it for next show. But the Best Picture nominees for the Chicago Film Critics, The Handmaiden, Jackie, La La Land, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight.
So absolutely expected, you knew were complete mortal locks And I'm happy about seeing them on this list. That's all I'll say for now. La La Land, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight. Absolutely did not expect, but pleasantly surprised with, The Handmaiden. Really excited to see that among those top five. Absolutely did not expect and not very pleased with Jackie, despite all the other aspects of that film I love. I just can't imagine it being among the five best films of the year. But
there must have been like a CFCA Jackie screening we missed.
Where
they pumped some gas in the room.
They all drank the Kool-Aid on Jackie. 8 nominations for Jackie, Manchester by the Sea, La La Land had 7, Moonlight was the leader with 11, and The Handmaiden was just behind La La Land with 6 nominations. So we hope that was some fun going through those ballots and hearing some of our favorites from the year. And we didn't even get into the screenplay categories. And again, the winners of all of those categories will be announced by the time you hear this show, and you can find that list over in our show notes at filmspotting.net. A lot of these titles have already come up, Josh, but we do want to note that we have already posted the Golden Brick poll, and listeners have a say in which film wins the Film Spotting Golden Brick for 2016, our Under the Radar, Underseen Movie of the Year, and they come to us from a new filmmaker or just someone who was new to us. And those titles include Camera Person, The Fitz, Kreisha, Tower, and James Solomon's The Witness.
So here's what we want you to do. See as many of those films as you can, and a couple of them are widely available to stream. And then go ahead and vote in the Golden Brick poll. That's at filmspotting.net. The winner of this year's Golden Brick, it will be determined in part by your vote, by the listeners' vote. We throw that in the mix along with everyone else who's on our distinguished panel of friends and fellow critics, and you have an equal weight as my vote, as Adam's vote. So
well,
go
your
ahead.
Vote, but...
Well, I figured there's probably some funny business behind the scenes. Go ahead, catch up on those films. You won't be sorry, and you'll get to vote. We're going to announce the winner of the 2016 Golden Brick live. That's at our year-end wrap party. That is going to be Friday, January 13th. We hope to see you there. We will also have ticket information for that available at filmspotting.net.
Our email address is feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm at Filmspotting. Josh is at Larson on Film. And our website is where you can find 11-plus years of reviews, interviews, and top fives. If you haven't already, please check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU. You can find both in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Out in wide release, Collateral Beauty, the new film starring Will Smith, Edward Norton, Kate Winslet, and directed by the filmmaker behind The Devil Wears Prada, David Frankel. And of course, Rogue One is out as well, reviewed by us earlier in the show to mixed reaction. Fair to say?
Yeah, let's say mixed.
Mixed. Out in limited release, Things to Come, the latest from Mia Hansen-Love, and starring Isabelle Huppert, another one of her standout performances from this year, getting a lot of attention from various critics group. And La La Land, reviewed on last week's show, is finally out. See it in the theater.
Yes.
I wish I had seen it in the
yes.
theater and not in my living room, and now I'll have a chance.
Well, yeah, we're going to plan a family outing to go see that. Do go search this out. I know you're probably hearing a lot about it and might think that it doesn't need any more support, but that's just critics talking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a smaller release movie that people need to go pay money to see so that it will spread to further theaters and more musicals like this might get mm-hmm. made.
Next week, this time we promise, part one of our top 10 films of 2016 with The Next Picture Show's Scott Tobias and Genevieve Kosky. What's your favorite film of 2016? You can leave us a short voicemail around 30 seconds, and we may include it in next week's show. The number is 312-264-0744. You can also send us an MP3 file, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. Quick favor, we'd like to ask as well, if you enjoy the show, go ahead and give us a rating or a review on iTunes. It does help us to reach new listeners. Our music this week, it comes from Chicago's Whitney. It's from their highly praised 2016 album Light Upon the Lake. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.